Good morning, sir. Our discussion was done with our chief director. We in turn discussed it with our DDG. So we get our directives from that level.
I'd want to just think about it. But,
yeah.
Okay, the proceed going to clause 20. Clause 20 has been amended by the insertion of paragraph 10. You will remember that in terms of clause 15 on page 56, we had an option that the child, in respect of whom a children's court order has come to an end, must be assisted to apply for refugee status. And the committee was in favour of that option. In light of that, paragraph C will no longer be needed.
So,
what I'm saying is that because of the fact that the option that a child should rather be assisted to apply for refugee status has been accepted by the committee, seeking them to be deleted, meaning that the child will not then be assisted to apply for temporary residency, but rather be assisted to apply for asylum.
Can't hear you, Mr. Anderson. Please raise your hands to indicate you want to speak. Mr. Anderson.
Let's see, John, follow the procedure. How does the child qualify for asylum? Because we'll found fear of persecution, that's the only ground for asylum.
Mr. Jeffries.
Point of order.
Yeah, point of order. We dealt with this last week. So Dr. Amosi wasn't unfortunately there. That's why Mr. Steelman says it relates to the intersection we dealt with earlier. So he can now take this back. You can ask outside the meeting, maybe. Mr. Jeffries.
Subsection 4 has been amended by the addition of the word taking into account the likelihood that a holder of the permit may be armed, killed, or trafficked again if he or she is taken into a country of origin or the country of conversion or a trafficker. And I would just like to refer you to footnote 124, and there you will see that the primary committee indicated that it must be left to the DG of the Department of Home Affairs decide on what humanitarian grounds and business permit should be issued to a victim of trafficking and in what circumstances it should be extended. Subsection 5 has been amended by the deletion of the word that has been extended in terms of subsection 4. And this amendment was included based on public hearing submissions that we've received, which suggested that all victims who have been provided with a visitor's permit should be allowed to work or study in the Republic, meaning that if a victim is able to support him or herself, the victim should not be dependent on the government.
Honourable members, you'll see from the footnote that if the committee feels necessary, it needs to make its views known on this particular issue.
Clause 21 has been amended as indicated, based on submissions received during the public hearings, which stated that the onus to prove that the victim of trafficking might be harmed, killed, or trafficked again if returned to his or country of origin, should not be placed on the victim. Also looking at the wording in subsection 2 that has been borrowed from section 27 of the Refugee Act. Thank you.
good thing for 2021 both.
Is that what is in the Refugees Act, or is this thing different?
We tried to do was to formulate this provision in line with what is provided for in the Refugees Act. Because if you look at the refugee, a refugee doesn't need to prove that he cannot go back to his own country. But the Director General and the Department of Home Affairs have a petition based on information that they have for him. So we tried to align this provision with what is currently provided for in the refugee.
I don't want to let you back, but I wish to recall that, in terms of a comment, in a very succinct manner, things which are said since the beginning of our deliberations on this bill. And that is my concern, that this entire system from 19 to 21 is going to have broad range unintended consequences on the same basis as the Refugee Act system, creating a backdoor to legalizing illegal immigration and placing on the state burdens which the state cannot possibly satisfy, leading to the creation of another system which will collapse on the same basis as the refugee system has collapsed to a point of no return.
Could you clarify to me, the Director General decides, where does he get the information from and how objective that information?
If you go and look at subsection 2, you will also see that we say that the Director General may request any information or clarification that is necessary from the victim, and you would also be able to consult with other agencies.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that these sections, I mean, I hear what Dr. Ambrosini says, and I think it's something we've got to watch out for, but these are sections, as far as I understand, that are required by the UN protocol, that provision is made. I think, as Mr. Bassett had said, Home Affairs wants to relook at that, and they must do that urgently, because this bill has been around for a considerable amount of time. But effectively, what it's doing is the protection and recovery period during which they become effective cannot be a foreign country. And then they may get they may get a temporary permit, and they may get permanent residence. I think we just need to check in terms of the refugee. Is there anything different which is being said? Are there any additional rights being conferred? So obviously the recovery and protection period is new for traffic victims, foreign traffic victims. But as far as 20 and 21, is there anything that's changed? I mean, it doesn't apply to other refugees. But effectively, these are refugees. If nothing's changed, why don't we just simply say those sections of the refugee that are fine?
Just in respect of Clause 21, something that I forgot to mention, this provision has been discussed with the Department of Home Affairs. And the Department of Home Affairs is a review that victims of criminal victims in the countries of origin are rather refugee status and not be granted permanent residency.
As I recall, the refugee status issue is a 5-year period, and then at the end of that, if it's of the opinion of the Director General that you still can't go back, then you can get permanent residence. And that makes more sense.
The next chapter deals with services to adult victims of trafficking. With the visited Law Course 22, but before he actually does it, I would just like to, the Department of Social Development submitted a four-point submission last week. And if we go through the submission, I will just put in any request for social development, just and then comment to the next. What the Department of Social Development wants to see in this chapter is that it should clearly state that government centers can also be accredited to provide services to adult victims of trafficking. I remember when we submitted a bill to the state law advisors for certification, we had the provision in the bill where we have to sign organization to also include a government facility. But this was deleted by the state law advisor who felt that you do not need to specifically mention that government facilities can also be accredited. They would be able to apply for accreditation provided that they comply with the requirements for accreditation. That's the reason why it was deleted. With the benefit will then just continue.
Thank you, Chair. It deals with accreditation of organisations to provide services. Perhaps I should start off with the amendments in clause 7 to introduce that. I think it was Ms. Schaefer and some other committee members were concerned about there being no transitional arrangements for the accreditation of services. So what we've done here in subclause 7 is really to borrow provisions from the Child Justice Act, and it really is almost related to the Child Justice Act and relating transitional provisions and time frames. So subclause 1 says, subject to subsection 7b, an adult victim of trafficking may only be referred or dealt with in terms of section 14, an organisation which has been accredited and has a valid certificate of accreditation. So that's the introductory provision. Why are we veering away from the word referred and possibly saying dealt with this, as Louisa said on previous occasions? I think because SAPS, the problem surrounding the word refer has to do with cost implications returned to you from place to place.
Thank you, sir. Thank you on that point, but the question of formulation, we only dealt with in terms of section 14.2 and the evaluation. I think there's something missing there.
I think if you're going to use referred, it'll be referred to and all dealt with in terms of.
We need to decide which formulation we want. He's given us the option of two.
I thought dealt with also referred to an organization. Dealt with two.
No, in terms of. Dealt with in terms of and referred to.
Perhaps the two should be after the referred to. Sorry, it is in the wrong place. It's confusing.
Sam, we did have a little bit of discussion on the third issue of the task force, but really, I think referred is correct. You refer them to an organization. Outside that problem, dealt with is not the correct word. And really, if there's going to be a dispute around, you're just going to transport them. That's pretty pity.
I couldn't agree more. When we were dealing with our discussion as a result of our discussions last week, we started making amendments. And when you start using notify or dealing with in the amendments that we have done as a result of our last discussions, you really are forcing the meaning of the word and it doesn't come out correctly. And that issue, I think, needs to be dealt with outside the legislation. So I think referred to is the more correct. Subclause 2, there were two paragraphs. The one, the Minister of Social Development must prescribe a system for the accreditation of organisations. And B, may prescribe the circumstances in which accredited organisations qualify for financial assistance within available resources. If I remember correctly, as a result, I think the committee decided that must be applicable to paragraphs A and B. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they will get money, but the minister must simply prescribe the circumstances in which accredited organisations qualify for financial assistance. Subclause 3, there weren't any changes. The system for accreditation must contain criteria for evaluation of programs offered by organizations to ensure that they comply with minimum norms and standards. They must contain mechanisms to monitor the programs in question, and they must contain measures for the removal of organizations from the system. Subclause 4, there was an amendment. It now reads the Minister of Social Development must, in a manner and within the time limit set out in the system of accreditation, subject to subsection 7C, consider all applications by organisations for accreditation and issue a prescribed certificate to each organisation that is accredited. There's a footnote there, 128, it says the portfolio committee may wish to consider splitting subclause 4 as it deals with different matters in the subclause. Paragraphs A and B refer to the certificate of accreditation, and paragraph C refers to the quality assurance process, and paragraphs D and E provide for the report containing the particulars of accredited organisations and the distribution thereof. What we've done there, and what we're trying to say is, subsection 4 dealt had paragraphs A, B, C, D, and E. What we are suggesting is that perhaps we split subsection 4 up and just keep paragraphs A and B, which deal with the certificate, and then create a new subsection 5, which would replace paragraph C, that deals with the quality assurance process, and then have a new subclause 6, which deals with the compiling and maintaining of a list of particulars of each of the accredited organizations. And subclause 6 would have a paragraph D as well, which also relates to the list. So really it's just a drafting formulation for the committee's consideration.
Steve Smart, before I recognize you, somebody's cell phone is terribly irritating. Please put it on meeting mode. Honorable Steve Smart?
Thank you, Dan. The issue of this accreditation being valid for 4 years, is there a provision that in that 4 years, say now the organization lapses in its resources or something, that can be relooked at? That's the first issue. And then, Chair, I don't think we covered the option B, may or must prescribe, to be then decide in terms of must. It must be must and not may. Did we take that decision? Just on that second part, what happens if an accredited organization, due to lack of funding or whatever, is not able to satisfy the criteria, can that be looked at in a 4-year period?
That I know there is a quality assurance process that must be conducted. And they may be removed from the system.
I just want to see if that's quality assurance an ongoing thing, because what happens if they comply initially for accreditation but their standards then decline to the point where they don't comply any longer? What happens then? Is there something to do with that?
Yes, I think the idea, and as I said, I think these provisions were also borrowed from the Child Justice Act, where the service providers responsible for diversion programs, there's also quality assurance, and the detail I think that you're talking about there is in the regulations as far as I can remember.
Mr. Chairman, I often discussed, and I'm not going to do it again, my concern that the accreditation centers will have an interest, a financial interest, in creating as many people as possible, because that's the source of the revenues. So the issue of the supervision and checking who they're doing, what they're doing becomes very critical. My concern with staff 5 is that we are imposing a duty without identifying who carries the duty. Arguably, it would be the minister. But I would, given the importance of this aspect, I would give consideration to the need of identifying a specific organ. Even if one needs to establish an organ, a review panel, somebody who does make sure that this foreseeable abuse is going to be contained. There are lots of people out there with extreme needs. Resources are going to be made available. There are going to be people who also in good faith will try to match those resources to the needs of the people beyond the intended purpose of this piece of legislation.
Chair, I mean, unfortunately, Dr. Andrasini wasn't here last time, and we've specified that the power to determine who a victim of trafficking is remains with the department. I just wanted to point out that the under sub 3, the system of accreditation must contain C, measures for the removal of organizations from the system where appropriate, and I think 5 is something that we're not having any more review panels or any other bureaucracy, statutory bureaucracy. So I think 5 is adequate. The process must be conducted, I mean, presumably by the Department of Minister of Social Development. So I think it's fine. And then also the period is for a maximum of 4 years. So presumably if they run out of money, but they're largely going to get money from the state, then presumably they will fall flat of the accreditation system under 3C, or power that rather.
I was just going to make that point as the minister that the credit organization, not themselves, and the minister is going to the victim of trafficking. In fact, as well, the accreditation is not by themselves. That's right. So the minister does that, but the fall for them.
I'm not going to deal with the, have I dealt sufficiently with sub clauses 4, 5, and 6?
Yeah.
Just to come in clause 4, sub clause 4,
yes.
The Department of Social Development suggests that Minister of Social Development should be replaced with Director General of Social Development.
The Department
of Social Development.
The DG itself?
No, sorry, the DG Social Development.
DG, that's two questions.
But I do not specifically indicate who actually requested. I assume that I have to
talk to the DG. All right. John J.P. followed by some sort
of. It's an administrative function, so I would have thought it should be the director general.
Saying that you might be given as an option number 6 of the Minister or the Director General. Again, I think that's the Minister of filing and containing a report that should be the Director General.
Well, that's the power to delegate to.
Then, shall we go on to sub-clause 7, and this is really verbatim from the Child Justice Act, dealing with accreditation of these organizations. Let me just take you through. It provides that the Minister of Social Development must, within 2 months after the commencement of this Act, table the first regulations envisaged under subsection 2A, prescribing a system for the accreditation of organizations in Parliament for approval. The committee might not want the approval aspect there, but it's something that the committee can decide on. Not later than 14 days after Parliament has approved the regulations, as provided in subparagraph 1, must make and promulgate the regulations and publish a notice in the Gazette inviting applications for the accreditation of organizations as provided for in the system, which applications must be submitted within 2 months from the publication of the notice, and then within 2 months after the closing date for applications, the Minister must ensure that all applications received are considered and decided on, with preference being given to the finalisation of applications in respect of organisations which existed at the time of the commencement of this Act. And then every organisation which existed at the time of the commencement of the Act and provided services to victims of trafficking may continue to operate and provide such services until it has been informed of the decision in respect of its application in terms of this section. So that is that really are the provisions, those are the provisions that were borrowed from the Child Justice Act.
Now, I just want to know how is it working with the Child Justice Act, how did it work? Because the way I see it here, you're looking at a minimum of 6 months before anything happens.
And those time periods, as I say, we can talk about as well, and make them shorter. Social Development is here. I'm not too sure whether they are the people that deal with child justice, but they may be able to assist us.
I mean, what do we do if there aren't enough organizations that actually apply or are accredited? Same one.
Firstly, the 2 month period is that one wants to get this done quick, and I know they are working on the regulations already, so we trust that it will be sufficient time. Was it also 2 months for the Child Justice Act?
Got the Child Justice Act here, just if you.
It's not really relevant because we want it done as quickly as possible, and there was an indication that they're working on the regulations already, so I support the 2 months. Secondly, the issue of does this also cover your. Stephen referred to the state departments that also don't need accreditation or something. Where do they fit into this? Do they have to apply? Remember when you referred to the certification process, you said there are state institutions that fall under the definition, but would they have to apply?
Yes, if they want to be accredited, they will have to comply with all the requirements.
Okay, just firstly, maybe regulations should go under the regulations section, so that they're all together. Guide us on the Child Justice Act, because what we did there was we gave a long period, we specified, I think, a year and a half before it could come into effect, to give everybody a period of time to implement it. It seems a bit odd that you have this Act coming into effect, but you don't have regulations for accreditation. What happens in that 2 month lunar, or longer in fact, that's tabled, and then it's got another period. So I would prefer a system where the regulations come into effect when the Act comes into effect. I seem to remember that's what happened with the Child Justice Act, or what was meant to happen with the Child Justice Act. Then I think the power to Parliament to approve, not a bad power exercise, but maybe we want to have it as a deeming approval, not a blockage. In other words, that it must be tabled to Parliament, and if Parliament doesn't approve by a particular period, deemed to be approved. Parliament has the option, rather than this is effectively a veto, and if Parliament doesn't get together to approve, then it's and there's no period given to Parliament to approve. So there's got a problem with that. I would have rather have seen a deeming provision.
Yes, I think that deeming provision is also in the Child Justice Act, so we can put something in like that. That was right in the end of the Child Justice Act.
Can we not word it so that I know, before the Act come into effect, it's got no legal force, so nothing can really be done legally. Unless we say the section has come into effect 3 months before, or 6 months before must come into effect 2 months before the Act comes into effect, the rest of the Act comes into effect. But isn't there a problem? You don't have, the accredited organisations are quite central as far as the supply of care and support.
So you've got a problem, haven't you, that for 2 months, and there's different sections come into force at different times, that you don't have accredited organizations.
Provision which says that the organizations which existed when that comes into operation can
contract. Yeah, I think the bottom line would be just look at what was done with Child Justice. I seem to remember that they were into effect. It can't be done because I can see there's a legal problem of you can't enforce a act that hasn't come into effect. But to see what can be done. I'm worried about that lacuna. And I don't think I don't really like the 2 months. I mean, it's pretty arbitrary. I thought I saw somewhere that DSD wanted 6 months, or maybe I'm wrong. Am I right? Or no. Okay. Table. But given that this is going to be around for some time, you've got lots of time. I would really have thought that it's, as soon as the Act comes into effect, then table. But I don't know what other members of the committee feel. I think with Child Justice, it's very redeeming for the provision. That's what we did there, so that Parliament can't, through its own problems, hold it back here.
So you're saying 2 months is too long?
I would have said, as soon as the Act comes into effect, or whatever the wording would be, the minister is stable. Because that's on the basis, basically, that from here it goes to the NCOP. In the NCOP, it then may be further amended. If it is, it comes back to us. And we can even look at if this act, and it may be something it inputs from the department, if they feel they're going to need time to implement it, then come and tell us how long. So that maybe we specify, you should be an incremental application, so that doesn't this all happen when the president signs it? Because he signs, he assents to it, and then he sets the date for its implementation. Usually the two are done together, but in the case of Child Justice, you would remember we left a year and a day, I think about a year and a half, to allow departments to get everything ready.
Thank you, Chair. Mandla Masapola from Social Development Legal Services. We are currently busy with the regulations. We have made provision for some of the aspects that have been raised, and we believe that perhaps we could use a period between publication and coming into effect to get some of the finer logistics ready. The period of 2 months should be fairly enough. So perhaps what could happen is that the act can be published, and then it could come into effect at a date to be promulgated, to be proclaimed by the president, which we will use that period then to have everything ready. But yes, I think we might need some time.
Okay, the bottom line to all the departments. DSD, particularly NPA, Justice Police, or nobody can they go back and think about it and come and make submissions to us on the implementation?
I've got the Child Justice provision. Service providers there, the Minister of Social Development must, before the commencement of the Act, table the policy framework for accreditation system. 3 months after tabling the policy framework is published a notice in the Gazette inviting applications, and 4 months after the closing of the application. So there the time period was a whole lot longer. The other option is possibly not to have such an way whose acts are implemented is to frame it in such a way that the Act comes into operation after everything has been done, so you don't have that sort of transitional approach once it comes into operation, the conventional way.
Or incrementally.
Yeah, I really want to.
Yeah. is, I mean, we're talking, we're throwing things around, maybe let's see the officials of us sit down, I mean, under Mr. Bassett's guidance and come up with a proposal for us.
Guidance, Mr. Bassett, with yourself, TSD, police, I'm not sure where NPA would be involved, and Home Affairs.
So just on, I don't know if it's appropriate now, but on B7B.
Yes.
It says until it's been informed of a decision in certain respect of the application, and perhaps it can be argued that that is therefore implying that they have to have a class, but I think maybe we should be a bit more specific, because otherwise you might have organizations just continuing and saying, well, I haven't received that application, so yeah.
Clause 8 is really just a delegation provision which allows the Minister of Social Development to delegate any powers to a provincial level. This, and I'm hoping that my colleagues in social development can assist here. This is what we're going to propose as, in our judicial matters amendment brought to the Child Justice Act, because I think of the way departments that have concurrent functions operate, and as I said, I'm hoping my colleagues from social development can assist if there is any need for that. There is a need to delegate these powers to the provincial level.
Question on that, but now that, I mean, this is from DSD, you've taken away the powers of the minister, some powers of the minister, and you've given the director general. Only the minister can delegate. Have you caused unexpected consequences? Is that those powers maybe wanted to delegate provinces as well? So maybe they could just look at that. So this thing about the six, the DG compiling a list of the organisation, that's for the DG. The DG must have the list basically. And then you say under 8, the minister may delegate, but not the DG. So have you got unforeseen consequences there that you would like to delegate to a provincial head? And if so, you need to address that.
So that brings us to the end of that provision. And I want to ask Louisa to say that.
The Department of Social Development suggests that the heading of Clause 23 should be amended as follows: norms and minimum standards. The Department has reviewed it, and norms are set things, and standards set things from time to time. So it goes further with norms and minimum standards than the heading. In subsection 1, we have amended it by the insertion of the Minister of Women, Youth, Children and People with Disabilities. Going to...
I thought she wasn't youth. Women, Children, Youth is with the Minister in the Presidency.
As subsection 3 has been amended by the deletion of the word for children as covered youth, we offer you that it is already covered by the first part, proper care for the children.
Are they there? Yeah. I also wondered about it, but I would have thought that usually international trafficking organizations seem to be quite deep rooted organized crime. And after consultation, so.
By prescribing minimum norms and standards,
okay, maybe we could ask, I see this was in the original bill, so maybe we could ask Ms. Steedman why she could have been, she could remember.
I will really have to go back on this because I certainly can't remember why she
is. Well, it's accreditation, so it's a background check actually. And state security have the capacity and resources to do background checks. Let's leave it there.
Going to page 24, subsection 1A has been amended by the deletion of the word counseling and we've replaced it with a word holistic psychosocial care. This amendment was initially supported by the Department of Social Development. While the department is now of the view that not all accredited organizations will be able to provide psychosocial care, and the suggestion is that we should rather use counseling and leave it as it was originally.
Chair, I agree with that. My question was going to be what is the legal definition of holistic psychosocial care? Maybe the legal people from DSD could tell us, but seeing they've withdrawn it, I'll let them off.
Going to page 45, paragraph 4 on the source 2, an accredited organization may offer a program aimed at a provision of rehabilitation services. The Department of Social Development suggests that rehabilitation should be replaced with the word therapeutic.
Why? What's the difference?
Good morning. Our response is based on consultative workshops in the provinces, and they didn't feel comfortable with the word rehabilitation. But as we conduct a little bit of research with regard to the word therapeutic rehabilitation and restorative services, I can read it out for you. Services are aimed at restoring the social function of those clients whose social function is impaired as a result of injury, disability, or any other chronic physical or mental condition. It is further aimed at helping people whose social function became impaired due to substance abuse, crime, violence, or chronic diseases to function optimally in the family and or in the community. Therapeutic. We feel more comfortable with social science with therapeutic, and we leave it in, we will propose that we leave it in with regard to substance abuse, the connection with rehabilitation. Thank you.
Therapy unfortunately makes too much sense to me, but it may offer, it's B isn't it that we're looking at, B1, so it may offer, it's an option, and why not then both rehabilitation and therapeutic? It seems that there are two different concepts. It may offer, I suppose.
Honourable members, please read the footnote. Cost implication there as well.
It's a may, not a must.
Okay.
Gentlemen, about clause 137, I just want clarity on that. That relates to drug rehabilitation. Footnote 137.
Oh. If it is rehabilitation, and I mean, it's general, I mean, it's an enabling provision effectively. So I would think that the DSD would be able to, I mean, it's funding these programs, so it would be able to determine what it's got the money for. I mean, 1A is what must be done. So those accredited organizations have to do that, and then B is what they may do. So much the problem if it's wider, and then DSD presumably when they accredit programs, able to say, look, we don't have money for a drug rehabilitation program for victims of trafficking for the moment, so no, we can't accredit you for that. Under this auspices, if you raise money elsewhere, that's fine. I mean, plan is broader. I'm not sure what a care plan is.
That's what the question is.
I prefer it as it is. I mean, it's broader. It then can include any plan.
That is why FDA also proposed that the compensation must be must go to CARA. I mean, it will be possible to provide for that.
Very often, if they've been trafficked, then often there's some other countries in the country. We're trying to say, can you tell me, yeah, probably not that city. So, I don't think that should
be. From Zimbabwe, or Swaziland? Okay. Long term or future?
My concern is more what is new in material value in this section as drafted. Because I do think there's a point to, with respect to the Ghanaian statement. The Libyans haven't arrived.
I was a little worried.
But I agree with Mr. Swart's point. Why don't we provide for the existing provisions? Because otherwise, to be fair to the prosecutors, you've got then another system to learn, and to be fair to our friends the magistrates, they've got another system to learn how to interpret. It's much easier if everything is covered in existing law and they refer to that law.
I wonder if you're going to be in touch with magistrates now. I wonder whether they're listening.
discretion of card one day. It seems like, the rest, but what Mr. Swart and I are saying is let's go for existing provisions and reference to those rather than reference to those existing provisions that need to reference in the Act.
So, just to make sure, it's just going to be a reference to section 300.
Thank you. Now, Mr. T, can I just say that there's one difference between section 300 and what is proposed here? Actually, two differences. That is, in terms of section 300, you can only claim compensation for damages and for loss of property. Whereas in this proposal, the department is proposing for damages or loss of property, or also physical or other injury, or being infected with a life-threatening disease, or loss of income or support. In other words, that is extra. But the department pointed out to me that there is another provision. In other words, you could still couple it with section 300 and just say that section 300 might be interpreted in a way that can include those other factors.
The formulation that was proposed to us was nothing in this legislation prohibits a victim's access to compensation provided for in the existing legal framework. That the NPA is proposal. I would support what you say that you need to extend it slightly. But then you're gonna and then it will be open to everyone.
It seems to me that there's a difference between traffic victims wanting compensation orders and other people. Because of the other forms of harm that they would have suffered. They would not have material, they are likely to have, or less likely to have material property that got damaged, etc. It's more these issues under 29.1a on page 47 that they would need compensation for. So I think it's important that it's in, okay? So I think let that be. But then as far as the procedures, can we not say the procedures of section 305, because the rest of the section is procedural. So all the prosecutor and the magistrate have to know is you can apply for this in terms of this act for a victim of trafficking. Therefore, to get it, you follow the section 300 route. And if there's anything else that's not covered, I don't have a copy of I don't like the thing that Mr. Swart read out in terms of the existing law, what is that existing law, you need to list the sections. Of the law, so everybody's clear. Compensation orders, but anyway, the bottom line is I think that let's look at what is different, and that's the issue that Mr. Nell has identified. 21A is different, and I think we agree that should go in. And then if anything else is different, let's hear it. Otherwise, it's then the procedure that concerns the section 300 or whatever the power provisions are that apply. Which is the title now, I hate the... without subject to change or whatever.
More discussed, the more concerned I actually am about the differentiation between victims, because not true. I mean, many victims of other crimes also suffer physical, psychological injuries. And rape victims can be infected with various different diseases, not confined to trafficking victims. And I'm wondering whether it's not actually unconstitutional to differentiate between victims.
This is what the menu on rejection.
Chair, quite correctly, this is a statutory provision for damages, and common law you can claim civil as well for damages. If you rape, you can, you know, bring a civil action against the rapist. I think this is something separate that we look at, but it is a concern, again, getting back to the issue of how we're treating our other criminal victims of crime. And that is a deliberation that can continue throughout the bill. Is there any chance, this follows a conviction, so there's no real chance of an abuse of someone that fabricates this, that's linked to the conviction. I think we had a brief discussion about the possibility of abuse of process, where a person fabricates the trafficking issue for compensation, for services. I think that's what we in our mind. But I support this provision. And I think we might have to play it out and see at some stage we might have to amend Section 300 broaden, but that's a separate issue for a different debate.
Perhaps I'm just
trying to the solution. I think we're sort of more or less all on the same page. I mean, look, it's important that. We obviously want compensation in the criminal court so that the victim does not have to go to a civil court and spend more time, more expeditious. We're dealing with a bill on trafficking, so let's provide for trafficking. But then let's maybe say in our report specifically that this issue must be looked at with a view to extending it to other sexual offences, or to sexual offences victims and other victims. But I don't think we can now, I think the options we've got is I don't think we can now simply amend Section 300 to apply to everything. We haven't gone through any particularly rigorous process on that, public hearings or whatever. But the other option is simply to leave it out, which I don't think would be preventing a different number of opportunities. So my suggestion is that we provide for this for victims of trafficking, because that's the bill we've got before us. But, you know, the report that we adopt, we call on the Minister to investigate the possibility of extending compensation provisions in 300, Section 300, to be wider, and then also particularly to look at sexual offence victims. I can't see how we can get any further than that. To me, it's that option, or the option of excluding it on the basis that it's not equal, which I don't think is desirable to do
that. Let me hear what you wish to say, and then I'll recognize you.
No, I mean, it's not that I don't want it, and I'd like to support it, but I would like to know from the state of funds whether they are of the unit that is constitutional, given those concerns. Because we don't really want to have a constitutional court chance again. And if it's possible that we can do that, then that's fine too. I'm quite happy to put it in there, but there's no guarantee it's going to be taken up. That you can't control it because you're not. No, probably not. But that's not the point. Anyway. Yeah, that's not. If we can just get some kind of visa, which I'd like to see what they have to say.
I'd just like to clear up any misconceptions that might exist regarding the access by the victims of human trafficking to the ICARA funds. As the POCA legislation stands now, they wouldn't be able to get direct access because those funds can only be made available to law enforcement agencies or to institutions, organisations or funds established to render assistance to victims of crime, but not directly to the victims of crime themselves.
In other words, to the accredited organisations that we have in the world before us.
That's correct.
That's fine.
Okay.
I'm going
to shape this point because I'm hoping we can move on. I mean, look, there is the noteworthy point that this is in the certified bill, so it presumably was certified. But maybe Mr. Bazza, I don't think there's anybody here from the State Board Advisors. Okay, then, sorry.
point of order, all the rules are fairly fine, even if they were subsequent to the agenda.
Now, I don't know why you were brought here or asked to be here.
The provisions of this bill, as specified, was in our view constitutional. And it didn't specify anything unconstitutional about the provisions of this
bill. I just point out that this came from the Law Commission, which was chaired by at that stage, the Constitutional Court Judge, Yvonne Kofodov, who had to amend laws to deal with some other ruling which he made. I see it got dissented to on Monday.
Give it some thought as well, come back and just to remind the committee as well on this topic, to amend section 300 to broaden it as it's been done in this clause, also have huge ramifications. I think we recognise that fact. You're almost bringing a civil case. How do you prove physical and psychological injury? It's so much easier once, during the criminal trial, where damage has been occasioned or there's been loss of property. That's so easy to determine, but determining life-threatening diseases, loss of income and support, does have ramifications, and will have huge ramifications for our criminal case left.
So just one more point. I think the real issue is what is the justification for treating people, and if you can come up with those reasons, then you can.
Just I keep time. I just want to restate my position in respect of these provisions. That I, since the beginning, I never felt that there is justification to treat this group of victims differently from any other victims in respect of compensation and in respect of the state structures provided for their assistance. Yeah, it is correct. I also try not to pay for my parents to sign the bank treaty. Yes, all affairs at the time, through that day, to Minister Buttarelli, expressed a reservation on the need of, as far as all affairs was concerned, of signing the treaty, and was overruled by justice.
In my court, it is the kind of thing that we follow. And the person has been a victim of crime, and then they have suffered paralysis. The entire process is just within the context. So this is the tremendous move.
So, Chair, just to get clarity, we're going to keep sub-clause 1 and then refer to existing clause. And then Mr. Harder had.
Section 300 is it, because we are not, common law is civil claim, it is not a civil claim. The FDA people on the shared strength, they're being confused as to what the existing law is.
That he wants to keep sub-clause 2 in cases where the amount of damage injured or suffered loss exceeds in order for compensation of civil action like the institution. I don't think it's necessary because that would apply in any event. But
no.
No.
Okay.
My fault is shape is people.
And then we.
Please, for my
oh, for
the magistrate, not you.
We obviously are now dealing with all of these. Section 300 is very limited. You know, much broader. Does one presume that the people involved, the prosecutors, you have to need a lot of evidence, a lot of expert evidence? Is that going to be the prosecutors going to have to do that? Because your damage is damage 300 exists, the damage. Physical, psychological, that's you're going to have to need subjective evidence, you're going to have to need medical evidence, loss of income, you're going to have actuarial evidence, and one that could then fall on the prosecutor. That's quite a substantive move. Has the prosecuting authorities given comments on that?
Look, I mean, this was in the bill before, so it's been subject to extensive scrutiny. I would have thought that while these issues of these factors listed under 1 to 4 are actually matters, if they are relevant, which would be an aggravation of sentence here. So I would imagine the NPA would be giving evidence on them anyway.
Thank you, mate.
Yes, you know, so if the prosecutor decides not to, that's up to them.
I can also just say that section 300, subsection 2, also states that for the purposes of determining the amount of the compensation or the liability of the convicted person, the court may refer to the evidence and the proceedings at the trial or either further evidence, either in voluntary or order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. That is then compensation to victim of trafficking, and I think the NPA also made a proposal in the next provision as compensation to the state. And I don't think these drafters have clarity on what we must take forward as far as that's concerned.
Maybe the other about my colleagues, maybe the NPA could just tell us what the issue was, because although I've got four documents from the NPA, none of them contain the amendment.
Can you please remind us?
Yes, please, Chair. With regard to clause 30, we initially proposed 11A and 11B, and in June, the committee requested us to get reasons as to why, because we have an issue for future legislation under COGA.
Mm-hmm.
And then last week we wrote Mr. George Harrigan, who gave those reasons, and the comment I wrote here was that we need to have a relook at this. We went and sat on the reasons given by Harrigan. And I made the summary. I think there are a few points that I need to read out to the committee, if I may. First is that there are official provisions in another legislation, and Drug Trafficking Act 140 of 1992, despite the fact that FOCA has its own official legislation. And secondly, similarities to the drug trafficking offences. The existing official provisions are more complex, and the requirement between the property, the offence, and also whether those were but this proposed official provisions will make it more expeditious for the prosecutor to just stand up in court for the upon conviction. And the other factor we took into consideration is that in most trafficking cases, we're dealing with mostly international syndicates. So the question of timing, because the poker is prescriptive, is prescriptive in nature. And then this one should make it more robust and expeditious, as I said. It's simplifying the process. And it will be to the benefit of the first issue.
The existing Section 30 is not about forfeiture. It's an order to the state for compensation for the expenses incurred in connection with the care, accommodation, transportation, and repatriation of victims. And I think that is there because these victims are quite costly to the state in terms of looking after, more so than any other crime. I mean, they don't have homes, okay, because they were trafficked. So that's what that is there for. And I it looks fine to me. As far as the forfeiture provisions, surely if you want to make those use of those provisions, you then charge them under poker too. But I'm worried about opening up widening this. I just think there may be unforeseen consequences. So if it's an organized crime syndicate that's involved in trafficking, well then they can be charged under poker. And you use those provisions to get forfeiture.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Last week, the 11A and 11B that Marshall's talking about, I think the committee asked the department to have a look at that and to come back with a response and on the constitutionality of that. So we haven't got there yet. But, so it is still open, those forfeiture provisions as well.
That's, I understood that to be flagged to come back to. If we then agree to insert those provisions, then the follow-up would be the forfeiture provisions as well, which are tied up at the fence. They lit. We need to take a decision when you come back to us. This would also then be flagged as to where we insert the car provision as well.
I think we're then not in our, I mean, we're waiting for the department to, as the more neutral body, come back to us. And so I think at our next meeting, hopefully they would have done that, and then we can look at the forfeiture provisions as well.
So in the course of what the department must do, we must also have a look at the CARA provisions as suggested by the MPA.
I think the issue for me is if this is organized crime, then why are they not charged under POCA? Maybe there's a need for provision to assist the prosecutors to say you can also charge them under poker. But I mean, poker is there.
Okay,
we can obviously include that in the training as well, but the judge is quite right. I mean, in that instance, as mentioned here, the poker legislation will obviously apply as well, but there are certain scenarios of implementing it at this stage, as Mr. Mukhatli explained just now about the integrities of the poker. So we've got the suggestion or submission from our side that maybe we should include that process under 11A and 11B here to sort of like alleviate the strictness of the poker legislation specifically. But yes, of course, I mean, the point is then it opens the door to other consequences as well, granted. But I mean, that's why we discussed the options here. We're looking at possibilities, what would be the best in this case for the prosecution. Thank you.
Yes, Mr.
Mr.
just mention that the asset forfeiture provisions don't specifically provide a procedure for victims or the state to make a claim. The state or a victim would have to apply civil procedures to access any property or funds which may be restrained or under preservation. Whereas the two clauses that we've just dealt with now provide a specific expeditious method of the state or the victims being able to access their funds. The asset forfeiture would be applied to take away what is not morally the rightful property of the perpetrators, proceeds of crime and all instrumentalities concerned in the commission of the offences. And it would be once any claimants have made their claim and been able to substantiate it in court, that they would get their bite out of the apple, and anything that may remain would then only go into the criminal assets recovery account.
I don't want to sound as somebody who stands on behalf of the perpetrators, but I do stand on behalf of principles of trying to. There is a tendency, I mean, the notion is that if somebody does something wrong, you capture him, you put him in jail, and that's how it pays. There is a tendency across the world to revive the old practice of taking all the properties of the felon and leaving it with nothing. And I think that Polka went a long way in that direction. And I feel very uncomfortable in pushing that line any farther in that direction, because we should remain an exception. We must be alive, especially in this context, that the wealth of a man serves a much broader purpose, with his family or her family, the people around, etc. So it's a punishment that often inflicted beyond the narrow confine of the personal conflict of the crime.
Part of
that is that
the
family
has benefited
from the
purpose
of that crime.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my point is that the claim was enjoyed. He had an edit to be supported by that.
Traffic individuals. I'm not sure who these other people are. obviously, if well, they're the victims. Okay? They're the ones who got moved. In fact, it came to the implies movement. Okay, so where does the family need? You know, you traffic somebody from a rural area. Okay, it's the victim who's being trafficked to the city. Where does the family need support?
Mr. T, it just provides for compensation and in respect of damages caused to the victim.
Would claim. And I mean, if the victim is in a coma, then somebody can act on their behalf. I mean, in any event, it's compensation. This is not a civil provision. It's a criminal. So the prosecutor asks on behalf of the victim who may be lying in a coma.
In order for payment, compensation for expenses incurred, reasonably expected to be incurred, care, accommodation, transport. So if an immediate family member provides the accommodation or transportation, they would surely have falls within that those expenses. It would seem to be quite broad. If you insert your immediate family member, then you've got to put it in the previous section, because then it will definitely be unconstitutional. For different treatments. So I think we've got to be consistent.
If the person has been trafficked, they will be the victim, they will have been moved. If they haven't been moved, then they aren't the victim and they will certainly need any assistance. So if somebody comes with a child and that child is also a victim of trafficking and they will not be able to be covered, we shouldn't be extending it to anybody else. Because there are always other victims of crime. I mean, if a wife who hasn't been shot since such a that night, you've never come to him as well. I mean, yes, I did, but it's not torture. So I think, you know, the victims, if the family members aren't with the victim, then they haven't been trafficked. And then they aren't covered by the
this with the department. I gave them a certain example. A person coming to South Africa with his family. One of the family members is a person who is a parent in a wheelchair. That parent is staying with him in England, for instance. It's not possible for that parent to be in a roof to be removed back. But that parent in a wheelchair also suffered as because of the fact that the father was a victim of death. So are we going to say to that person, sorry, you're on your own, you can see how to get back to England, you can see how where you're going to stay there in England? I'm just of the view that one should also make provision for such a situation. And if you look at the victim of trafficking, there's a definition of victim of trafficking. And it's only the child that's been declared a victim of trafficking, or the adult who's a victim of trafficking. In other words, no other person is a victim of trafficking.
Yeah, I really want your feel. I mean, this is all about compensation to victim of trafficking and compensation to the state. Okay, that's all you need to cover. Okay, because this is an additional provision to allowing not any compensation, but compensation in the criminal case. Okay, the civil remedies are still there. As far as repatriation and all that kind of stuff, that is for the victims. So I really do think, would urge that Mr. Nell stick to, leave, with respect to the SD people, leave the social issues up to social development and stick to the prosecution side. Not his area. We want our prosecutors to
tough.
I mean, to widen it, is this going to make it unmanageable? And
are not going to make sense. And Chair, from a time point of view, can we have spent enough time on this?
I still don't understand under what other kinds of circumstances a family member will be trapped. If they have come with their family member, then they will be trapped. How often can they get here? And what kind of damage do you have?
Recovery and protection period, which stops summary deportations of horror victims,
then what else do you need? Then you've got the provisions carrying on in Chapter 4 relating to temporary and refugee status.
If you look at clause 9 in dealing with the recovery and reflection period, you will see that the Director General of Home Affairs must first in the prescribed manner and subject to the prescribed conditions allow the coroner to stay in the country for its duration. But the reason why recovery deportation has been included was to provide for a dead time period before the Director General would actually then allow the victim to stay. It might be within a few hours or so to prevent the victim to be deported before the Director General of Home Affairs actually allow the person to stay in the country for the duration of 6 months, meaning the recovery and reflection period.
Make that much sense. I didn't realize people would be forced on the spot so quickly. But if it is necessary, if there is need to be a bridging gap, then that must go under the state's authority to the faculty section. Not here. So the bridging provision around
Could it form part of that provision of the recovery and the text?
It seems to me that it goes 31 goes into that recovery and protection period section, and the rest of 31 goes. And then, Chair, also, I mean, this section is deportation and repatriation of victims of trafficking. There is a section 34 on this essentially deals with repatriation cross border. Okay, if it's dealing with cross border, it should be surely more linked to. I mean, I know some of this is from people inside and some of it is people outside, but it just makes sense if it goes more there. And then we did also want a provision requiring. Transportation of
we spoke about it was repatriation and we asked to include the word return or internal people.
Coming to clause 32, clause 32 has been amended, 32.3 has been amended by the insertion of the paragraph I to make it clear that any victim should make informed decisions should they decide to return to their country of origin. And this amendment was included based on the submissions that you received in the conversation. Child which must conduct an investigation in some conditions under 25 from the reasonable grounds considered to be an adult victim of trafficking, notifying accredited organization or the provincial department of social development of that adult person, which must conduct an assessment referred to in section 14.7.
One which is there if you would like to hear, but what I want to know is 34A1. Why are we having to deal with the repatriation permanent residence to South Africa? So basically, you are a South African permanent resident, not a citizen. So it's, if you look at it, you're a citizen or permanent resident of the Republic. You're not a citizen. You get trafficked overseas somewhere else. Why must this country pay for you to return?
I remember that the protocol specifically refers to permanent residents. I just have to look which provision was it.
I'm just confused now. You spoke about bringing in the word return, but where is it? It's not anywhere here. Hold on.
So that this provision that we discussed last week.
My concern is that here you're only talking about foreign visas, these people being repatriated from the Republic, or to the Republic, but we aren't dealing here with people being returned to the community.
I hope we're not talking cross purposes, but the provision that we dealt with was on transportation last week. And it only referred to repatriation, and the committee asked us to include the word return to cater for people that are trafficked internally within the borders of the Republic to return to where they are.
Yeah, I mean, does this then only apply to foreign victims or victims being trafficked outside of Africa, in which case maybe should be reflected in the heading, because it's not very clear.
Isn't that what Mr. I wanted to get back to that question that Mr. Jeffrey raised, isn't on this chapter as well. Doesn't it also deal with internal returns, or is it only?
Supporting a child victim, but still not dealing with the adult victim.
It's covered under the chapter dealing with adult victims of trafficking. It will be clause 27 on French.
Trafficking victims
what we want to say about the return of internal victims, what we want to provide for the legislation, if anything. There is this provision under 27 there that they can't be returned unless it's all clear on the home front, as it were. Do we want to provide anything else? Surely there should be the accredited organization should assist traffic victims, I mean, presumably at the state expense, to be returned to back home. Some kids have ended up in Cape Town, they were trafficked from Limpopo. How are they going to get back? So that should be brought in, that there's a duty on the accredited organizations, you know, subject to as prescribed to deal with that, something like that. Mm-hmm. I think you've got to be careful about it. I mean, there's a lot of gray areas. You don't want, well, obviously they're going to be accredited victims, and DFD, I hope you've been told, we're insisting that you keep your power to determine who is victim of trafficking or not. That is not delegated to an accredited organization. It's too much self-interest. At the moment, there's an appeal mechanism, but we are very keen that the government keeps that. So, presumably, it would be the person who's been certified or what's registered, and the letter that they are a victim of trafficking. If it's internal, then government or the accredited organization must assist them get home if they want to go home.
Cross 35 doesn't do that?
Well, 35 is child victims, right? Okay, so I'm talking about, I mean, it could be a kid. But you see, then the difficulty is that this section 35 is not just cross border. So you need one, if you're going to have a cross border section, you need one for cross border, you need one for internal, and for internal, you do want to provide also where the victim has been trafficked, whether it's for labor or sexual purposes or whatever, from a rural area to a city. Somebody will help you get home. Duty on somebody to help you get home.
So I think that section 27 should actually come under this section also. And then maybe just put a deportation, repatriation, and return, obviously. And then just put all this together in addition to that.
In other words, what happens to the adult in this case, what happens to the child?
National Intelligence Agency, because it's
incorrect reference, and we've replaced that with State Security Agency, which is the correct title. We've also included there the Director General of Women. Youth will have to come out. Children and people with disabilities. You will also see that we have deleted paragraph D, D, E, F, and G, because they have been included under subsection 1. Going over to page 55, we have inserted a new subparagraph 4. That information should also be collected on the areas in the Republic 2 and from which victims are infected. Paragraph 9 and 10 have also been added. That information can be collected on the methods that are critical to keep victims in exploitative situations, as well as on the methods and goods used for trafficking victims within the Republic. With regard to clause 3, we have just corrected clause references. Clause 4, once again, we believe the National Intelligence Agency and replaced that with State Security Agency, and also include the Director General of Women, Children and People with
Disabilities.
Yes, you will come out.
Yeah, just want to record the position. I know that it's not going to be a consensus and it's not going to be the prevailing position. Nonetheless, I have a big problem in this section, this clause, the one we discussed, as well as the one we discussed earlier, to get the State Security Department involved in the investigation of any crime or anything which deals with crimes. And that's the function of the police. Whenever you get the intelligence apparatus involved in crime prevention or issuing regulations relating thereto, that spells out disaster.
What are the clauses actually saying in this service?
The consultation requirement here, as it was a consultation requirement afterward. Maybe in the clause that we discussed earlier, and the one discussed earlier was in respect of the making of regulations. This is in respect of the functions of this consultation. Now, you can say, as I'm sure you will say, that what's wrong with consulting? Consulting is denied. And I have a different take on the matters. We discussed it in the committee, which both you and I, the chairman, served. I've seen the dynamics which give the Department of State Security under the NIA a great say on things where they shouldn't have any say. There is a great deal of difference, often not based on information. And I'm very wary of expanding the power of intelligence apparatus within consultative processes in government. And it's something if I were to write this, I would put there.
Honourable members, I'd like to hear you on this matter. The Honourable Gibby Shaker, the end judge.
Stuart, when you look at the written, what exactly they are required to consult on, then I'm actually not convinced really. But your point about them doing evaluations, that's one thing, but that's not actually what they're being asked to do here. And I can well understand that they might well be required to go and check out certain organizations or institutions if they're expected to perhaps be a front for trafficking under the guise of looking after trafficking. But I don't think it's necessary actually to keep it in this particular context.
Yeah, look, are we dealing with on page 54, sub 2, that one?
Yes,
it is a quite wide. I mean, some of them, like the division or the divisions within which the police to be tasked with the investigation of trafficking cases, I mean, presumably wouldn't be particularly interested to the social development or SASA. Okay? But then things that, so what I'm saying is a wide range. But then things like the circumstances, whatever, so measures to be taken in order to ensure the protection of the trafficking person in South African ports of entry. And of course, intelligence, what's it called now, states, security, would have a relevant impact on that. The kind of information that this needs, okay, no, but you know, some of them are valid. It's really, I don't think we should be splitting hairs on an enabling provision there. Some of it is relevant, some of it is not. I mean, definitely SASA, I doubt, are going to have anything to say around the division or divisions of the police tasked with investigating trafficking. So I'd want to just raise that point. You know, is it not better to provide greater consultation than the lesser? I think we've seen in government that if you don't specify something to get consulted, then they can be left out by mistake. My chair, probably chair, is just the ordering, if I can move on that. This is general provisions, all right? And this is a section called National Instructions, and it deals with consultations, and then it's going to go on to deal with data collection. But yet you've got another data collection section with the accredited organizations, what they're meant to provide in another chapter. Yeah. I think all the research stuff needs to be together. And then the next chapter is on the administration of the Act, and that deals with the National Policy Framework. Now, you know, surely national instructions and directives come out of the framework. So my concern with this section is that maybe it's particularly well placed. I would have thought that it stems out of, it's not a general matter, it's an administration of the Act matter. So surely it all belongs in chapter 10. And then you include your data collection with the accredited organization's data collection. Can you look at that? I'm not sold on it, but can you look on that? But I do think that there's a bit of an anomaly that national instructions is separate from national, what you call it, directions, policy. National instructions on the Act and back on administration of the Act. Chair, also, I'm just interested, I should have raised it earlier, Dr. Ambrosini's dislike for the Act, is that the position, is this personal position or that the IFP and the protocol?
It's not very clear why he dislikes the Act.
He doesn't agree with the protocol, he should have signed the protocol. Is that the IFP's position or that his position?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have a measure of protection from the unwitting wit of Mr. Jeffrey, but the I expressed a view that was taken at the time by the relevant minister as a minister, which I expressed and conveyed to the other departments, as well as in Palermo to Minister Montramari, in my capacity, not as an IFP member or a political representative, but as a government official. So I think the question is your place.
Yeah, at the beginning, he actually indicated, my colleague can remind you that he didn't support, when he was talking about the provision of services, he said he would support this act. He then went on to elucidate around when he was advisor to the then Minister of Home Affairs. And he made it quite clear it was his existing position. And I wanted to know if that is existing. That his personal position or his party, or did his party not have a position?
Okay. I express my view in respect of the protocol. Everything that I say here, I say as a representative of the party. I think that if we start questioning one another, I don't question any of you whether you speak on behalf of your parties, which are deeply divided. I'm not sure which faction of the respective party one speaks. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, why you're allowing this to be done, or whether it is going to be official protocol for each member of parliament to place a mandate Yes, from the Alchemist Paradise. If you fit the protocol, I will take advantage of it in future occasions.
On that note, I'm going to call a coffee break and ask that we reconvene at 25:12.
Yeah. Sometimes when you order his location, bus or whatever, you can order for 20 buses for 15.
For 4 days?
No, yeah, I'm not. But the problem is that the chairperson called for a friend. Because we want to go to everybody. So now we have to wait for them. We break it. And I wanted this meeting to be over by 4:00, because if he had an after 1:00, I would be in trouble. I was supposed to apply for 20 during the 15. I applied over the law, but would have started during the 15. But the application, my son and I can't go by the question. If we are coming this morning, and the journey is along with you. Can't buy them because they have done since we were there. I'm supposed to have brought the carriage to move back. That's what I'm saying. So what if we're going to plan with you? That means we'll have to call up and return to work. I wish they could change the program now. But the sitting Thursday, after Tuesday, Wednesday, it has to be maybe different.
How can you buy the
I'm not going to do that. president won't go over president and So then that's why it's present under the industry time when you present our South Africans or Americans or Indonesians, so that's why.
Just want to check how many pages are left.
All alone.
More than 10.
Familiar photocopy?
No, I'm
okay.
Just there checking there how many
okay.
pages are left with.
Oh! Yeah, I think so. Get on one. Sorry, Wunan, I meant to ask you. Did last week Thursday, when did you phone Radio 2000? I was listening to Radio 2000.
Huh?
I was listening to Radio 2000.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
You did. That's why I was
yeah.
So it was you.
No. Actually, there's somebody, Radio Bani, who prepared an hour on phone like that. They had this person on Radio 2000 commenting about
anti-justice, yeah. Because people like,
I don't even know who listened to Radio 2000.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. A child witness that flows, whereas if it's a witness and in particular a child complaint, doesn't
together.
Going over to page 49, the question is also whether one should include your complainant or witness. And I'll take section 153 of the criminal procedure act, and there they use the word complainant and not the word witness. So it seems to be more appropriate to also refer there to complainant.
Why do you want witness correct you? Here you want complaint. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because this paragraph refers to section 154 of the criminal procedure.
Okay, so 154 refers to complaint.
Okay. Can't you hear?
We've also inserted two new paragraphs, that is I and J. But I would like to refer you to page 37, clause 17.2, because this relates to what is provided for on page 37, clause 17.2. On page 37, we have two options there. It's an option in respect of subclause 2B and C. And the proposed amendment on page 58 will only be included if the option on page 37 is accepted.
On page 37, we've got two options we discussed it last week. It's either in the prescribed manner in accordance with the directive, so the committee feels that possibly that it should be dealt with by the regulations, and it will come out here as we said. On page 37, that's dealing what we discussed last week is the criminal prosecution of victims of trafficking, and where a prosecutor needs to refer a matter if a child comes before court in a criminal matter and it appears that it's a victim of trafficking, then that person must be referred to the child protection organization or credited organization. And the question arose, how is that going to be dealt with? Again, we're talking about the referring and the notifying. The question playing around the word, those two words, where we got guidance from the committee earlier this morning to say that we must think about referred to.
Sorry, are we not taking
a
decision?
You want to take a decision?
What did we say last time? I mean, what's the difference since then? One is prescribed, the other one is in the national directives.
National directives will most probably be easier. They can amend a whole lot easier than with regulation.
You see, and this is another one of my fault, forgive me, but I have a conservative approach to directives and policies. Give me a break. Directives and policies statutorily provided for. The only, a directive is something that applies from one department to another department. The typical are the treasury directives. They should not affect the rights and obligations of the citizen. Once we start providing for them in a context like this, becomes very problematic, because the only thing, the only administrative form of legal provisions capable of going outside government should be a regulation. All that which stays within government should be directives if they're formal, or policies if they're not formal. And writing about the need of having policies in a law is a little of a contradiction, because that's an inherent power of government. And I raised the point before, I would go through this very carefully and make sure that everything that affects third parties is regulations,
And if there are directives that only relate to things which are internal aspects of the interdepartmental relations, the relationship and governance aspects.
Thank you, John. If you are dealing with other organizations outside government, I think we should rather go to this one.
I see there are three differences. There's the old B, which is to simply refer the child to a designated child protection organization. The option spelled it out more. Notify and facilitate the referral. Okay. Then I prefer the option generally. The option deals with both a further internal option of directives or prescribed. Given that the beliefs for making such an issue of the facilitation, the B2 part, would it not make better sense that this is in support of the others that it is prescribed? So, in short, what I'm saying is I prefer the option that we've got, which spells out 2 B and C on page 37 in greater detail, and that within that option we work with a prescribed manner. I mean, we saw it, but I don't know, the police here, I don't know, I mean, Dr. Cullinane is the one who was raising it, they're not here, but I mean, he made quite an issue of the fact that the police are here, but Dr. Cullinane is not here. It was Dr. Caldenes who made a big issue about the police can't transport people, which I don't agree with. But maybe in the light of that, it's better to say prescribed rather than in directives.
This basically then means that we do accept the amendment on page 58, the addition of the IMJ.
We're saying prescribed. So they come out of the directives, okay. They're gone. Nice try.
Okay, going to paragraph K, we have just corrected the cross references. Going over to page 59, clause 39, we've just included chapter 2 off before the Workers Act. And in clause 40, we've just corrected cross references, and that brings us to the end of chapter 9, of chapter 8.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point that I would like to clarify. I noticed that in this bill, there's absolutely no reference in subsection 8 of clause 38 to the reference of social context training, which is specifically included in the Sexual Offences Act section 66.2b and section 97.4 as well from the Child Justice Act. And I think it plays a huge role for social context training to be included in this piece of legislation as well. One reason is simply because of the fact that if you look at trafficking and the predominant number of cases that we have on trafficking, far, you're dealing with about 80% of those cases, more or less, give or take, that specifically relates to sexual offences. And the essence of an understanding of social context will play a crucial role, specifically for the prosecution, and I'm sure for other role players as well. So I would submit that should be included under section or clause 8, sub clause 8 of clause 38. In this regard, in this piece of, in this book. Thank you.
If therefore sexual offences, why shouldn't it be there for this?
Alright. Thank you for that. National Policy Framework.
Yeah, I'll try to deal with this. Chapter 9, page 60 of the book. National Policy Framework, but provision 42, clause 42 hasn't changed, but hasn't just including the fact that the minister must, after consultation with a whole range of ministers and including now the women, children and people with disabilities, and rather than adopt a national policy framework, must approve a national policy framework. I think that was referred to footnote 154. It said the portfolio committee raised a concern whether the minister has the power to adopt the national policy framework, and we suggest that it means that it be changed to approve. And then later down in sub clause 2, the same amendment. I refer you to footnote 155. In sub clause 2, the minister must, within 2 years after the commencement of this act, approve and table the policy framework in Parliament. And footnote 155, portfolio committee to guide on whether we should provide four time frames. And I think the committee said last time they would like to reconsider the 2 year period and should it be shorter. And that's all as far as clause 42 is concerned.
I think
while waiting for 2 years, the implication is that for 2 years we're going to be going with an uncoordinated, non-uniform, uncooperative approach. So I would be a bit wary of that. I would like to see a shorter time frame, but what is realistic from the point of view?
My experiences with sexual offences, that's what I was going to raise, sexual offences. You remember the debate we had, the problems, and having to extend it every year, 4 years later, we only got that this year. I think we need a time frame. But then are we going to sit in the same situation of how compared to the bottom? How long would it take? Are we going to face the same problems we faced with the sexual offences that we had to keep extending the period?
Once every 5 years under C. Yes.
I think we've learned a lesson. honestly speaking, for the lessons that we learned, we believe that a shorter period would be in order. 1 year will be fine.
Chair, let's change it to 1 year, but I would really suggest that the NPA and the department, because it's the minister, not the national director, that's going to have to do this. Check whether it's really realistically viable.
When the sexual offences that wasn't compliant, would we grant those extensions?
Can we then agree with that before you commit yourselves to this, please just check thoroughly, okay?
No.
Is that what we're seeing?
That recording concern, which I stressed earlier as well, in respect of 42, 43, and 44. I mean, here we are spelling out statutorily what should be the actual approach in each and every, in implementation of each and every piece of legislation. And I don't think that this is appropriate in legislation. I don't think that we should have rigid committees forcing people to meet regularly when at times there may be an issue, at times there may not be an issue for the involvement of a department. The administrative cost of this, opportunity cost is enormous. If the DGs or their delegates are doing this, they will not be doing something else. That's my first concern. My second concern, again, in this respect, as previously stated, but here it becomes more clear, with this piece of legislation, as with other pieces of legislation, we are defining one step at a time what state security becomes, or what it means. And we are making it the business of the Department of State Security to get involved in the implementation of this act, in developing policies in respect of this act. And I, for one, am very, very concerned in getting the state security involved and police, because ends up unavoidably in a secret police mindset.
Chair, I think we were looking at one sectoral committee for various pieces of legislation. Is that right? Sexual offences and others, where we've got this set up. So I think this committee is not going to just meet for this act. And I think we need at some stage to get further clarity as to how that is progressing, that concept. So that will then, yeah. So it seems the first objection seems to be covered then. Thank you, Chair.
I've been a punter for the single intersectoral committee because at the moment we've got, and I see it in the draft on this option with respect to 43, because I think that at the moment you've got one for child justice, you've got one for sexual offence, so a third one is going to be problematic. However, it turns out it quite works within this overreaching. We've got, for example, Durko, which you don't really need the child justice international component, only really with the trafficking of kids. But having said that, I am wondering, given the volume, I mean, these intersectoral committees are difficult. I don't know how sexual offences and child justice is going. They're going any better, but inherently, I mean, people have problems finding time meeting. And let me ask the question, I mean, the same question as Dr. Ambrosini, do we actually need an intersectoral committee for trafficking? There's nothing for a statutory intersectoral committee. There's nothing stopping officials getting together. Does it need to be statutory? The moment you make it statutory, whether it's part of a broader committee or a standalone committee, you then have got obligation. And at the moment, we are having a mere handful of trafficking cases at a time. The NPA, through you, Chair, how many have you got at the moment on your rolls? Roughly.
But the last time when we submitted the report, we spoke about 34 cases, of which were finalized about 5 so far. So it's not a huge load at all.
So, Jeff, it's basically that worry. I support the idea of one overarching sort of vulnerable groups structure, but thinking about it again, and also maybe here, well, no, I'm not really hearing from number 6 points. But is there enough work for this statutory commission on trafficking? When in fact, if the problem becomes acute, then you know, if there's nothing stopping, there's nothing preventing people from taking place. But I mean, because the difficulty is the way that you've drafted it, you've got people on the overarching committee who don't need to be there. They're only actually involved in trafficking. I would imagine the Department of Labour, I mean, maybe with sexual offences, is unlikely to have much interest in sexual offences. Sexual offences? Sexual offences. Not trafficking, yes, but not for sexual offences. So, you know, we may be having a problem of one size fits all, and I think my gut feeling is now maybe let's just leave sexual offences and child justice to be and not have an intersectoral committee for trafficking.
I've already kind of gotten to agree with your previous position. So I have to quickly do it.
change, but what I'm thinking is that the directors general have found administrative measures to deal with the multi-service committee that we have. Currently, we actually they actually meet on the same day, but have different agendas and different operational people coming to inform the legislation. The fact that the legislation is intersectoral, and it is a bit of, I believe it's not going to be an easy legislation to really agree upon, especially the kind of issues that we're talking about, who's going to transport the victims and so on. Those practicalities are dealt with quickly within the DGISD rather than at forums like DCPS platform. So I don't know, I'm not too sure, but I'm likely to believe that they'll be able to manage administratively.
What is interesting is that there is, what about the possibility of a subcommittee on the prevention as under I-65-6, subcommittee on the prevention of COVID? I would need to think through first whether I'm in favor of ditching the whole intersectoral medical tracking kit, but the backup position is that possibly a subcommittee which would deal with issues of trafficking when it comes up. Maybe that's something to consider.
Now we'll give you Schaefer, followed by Ms. Ambrosini, and then John Jeffrey.
I must say, in general principle, I'm not in favor of imposing legislative administrative obligations on staff. But, I mean, they need to show us that they need support. But, I mean, if they're going to be meeting anyway, the obligations are imposed in terms of the legislation. How they do it is really up to them. And I'm leaning towards agreeing that maybe we don't need this body. I mean, you can meet as often as you want anyway. It's up to the DG to decide that anyhow, how you conduct your operation. So, and this is a companion reason to keep it in, not finally saying, but I was tending towards saying maybe we shouldn't actually have it. Given the vast number of cases, 34 of them as well, I mean, to oppose specific meetings and numbers of meetings per year, that may or may not be necessary. And if it is necessary, then we would trust them to actually make sure that they haven't gone.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we have had legislatively, the issue to me is that we need to set up structures to carry out work and to respond to needs and pressures. And it would be ideal to have a structure for each and every problem. We need to prioritize there where there is greater pain, there is greater emphasis, and there are greater structure and administrative capacity. We have had legislation on the books dealing with a specific crime for at least 10 years, I would guess. We committed ourselves 11 years ago internationally to place this crime as the priority crime on the policy agenda of law enforcement agencies, and it has been. There has been lots of emphasis, lots of attention. I've been raising the difficulty time and again in this committee that I for one, don't know how generalized this crime is. South Africa. All we know is the statistics that there are 34 cases, 5 of which have been completed. And if we compare that to any other crime we know of, it becomes minuscule. So setting up all these for what it is, for all intents and purposes, a minor occurrence, how terrible and how brutal it might be, within the very complex tapestry of crime in this country, it would seem a misallocation of time of director generals and key personnel otherwise engaged in fighting corruption and other crimes.
General, I mean, just mine, look, I think we're easily dead horse in this case, but mine was more just, if you look at on page 62, clause 44, that's what the intersectoral committee does.
does the policy framework that can be done by SOC. It then looks at establishing an integrated information management system. And then it develops and reviews guidelines on the identification of victims of trafficking. And then lastly, under two, it's involved in a public information education exercise for the public and the victims of trafficking. So again, I think, I mean, maybe we don't want to take the final decision now, maybe we leave it in as it is, but I think the general tendency seems to be that there isn't a... I think maybe keep in your multi-sectoral committee, because I think that's critical to have one with three subsections, but I think you don't even need one on trafficking statutory committee. But leave it in for the moment, but I think that seems to be where the committee is going.
I can also just check, if we were to remove it completely, what obligations, are there any obligations in terms of it, then I can just double check that there aren't any other obligations that will be taken out, and that we can maybe impose them on the parties and the whole one.
The one thing is, it's two functions relating to the intersectoral committee. The one would be the collection and analyzing of data. The second one would be public awareness programs. So the question will then be, who will be responsible for that if we delete the provisions related to the IRP?
Together with GCIS.
I think with public information, it would be Justice. I mean, Justice is the lead department together with other government departments. We don't have to specify. I mean, you might find the Human Rights Commission, they're not a department, but they want to get involved. Women, children, they want to get involved. So I think you make them the lead, is responsible for, together with other departments, to educate. And then as far as the collection issue, again, responsibility on justice in working with other partner departments.
Just as a general comment, the fact that there are 34 cases, again, I tend to over-exaggerate the problem, but I think you've got to be very careful to say, because there are 34 cases, that's the size of the problem. Maybe I can ask the FBA, are there any cases of domestic servitude, domestic labour that have been prosecuted, or is it purely the sexual offences side?
To answer that, so far it's purely to sexual offences related.
So that immediately opens that whole side open, that there are... We can't just say there's 34 cases, therefore that's the size of the problem. We know there's a problem with data, but I think you've got to be careful to underemphasize the extent of the problem. But on this particular issue, we can decide at a later stage. I'm not here nor there as to this, but just be careful about generalizing that it's not a municipal problem. I think we need to be upfront about that.
Thank you, Chairperson. Actually, I wanted to say what Mr. Swart is saying, that, you know, this type of an offense affects the people who don't have money and information, usually rural women and children. So we can't just say it's 34. It may be that the reporting is very low and the awareness is very low. These 34 recorded ones just goes to show us that we need as a country to do a lot of awareness. Thank you.
Just wanted to point out that we need to refer a case to the NPA with a proceeding since he didn't have a case of domestic service.
That was meant in jest.
I just want to know, what is the actual number of victims that were involved in those 24 cases? Because it's not necessarily one on one. It can be a lot of people.
Do you give that information?
That was submitted in one of our previous reports. I absolutely correct. It wasn't only 34 victims. It was a far, far bigger number than 34. I don't know the exact number, but I can say that for you.
So there were 34 cases?
34 cases. Far more victims.
All right, so we're going to flag the issue of the intersectoral committee.
Yeah, I think there are two issues. The one is a statutory intersectoral committee. The services which is not provided for in the protocol. The other is for the issue of reporting and monitoring, which is provided for in the protocol and is necessary. So I think in the way we deal with it, the way we seem to be going, is that there doesn't seem to be a great eagerness for a statutory committee. The provisions relating and the responsibilities for collation of data and information and education, those need to remain. So maybe under the section, what is it, 44 on page 62, the issue of that these actually maybe should remain not for the intersectoral committee, for the department, so that those functions are not lost. Because then the issue I would urge that maybe 44 remains, but not as the responsibilities of the intersectoral committee, but the department, working together with other departments and other bodies. Effectively
I'm thinking in terms of the sexual offences sexual offences act, there is an obligation to report annually. We have been in Mora, and I'm just thinking, at least you've got a hierarchy within government that has the responsibility to collate those records. And therefore you've got an arm through which you can call the Director General to come and say, why is there difficulty with reporting? To ask the Department of Justice to be solely responsible for presenting reports on behalf of other departments without providing for provision for them to meet to discuss these reports, I'm not too sure whether we will be able to actually succeed, unless if the provisions ask for specific departments to come and report individually or separately. I'm not too sure. I'm thinking that's one of the ways in which we could see the powers of the intersectoral committee, more so that they meet only twice a year.
Firstly, who is the lead implementing or whatever it's called department in terms of the protocol? Justice. Okay. Now, I mean, each treaty, as far as I understand, has a responsible department which has to report. And not every, or hardly any, a minuscule amount of treaties have some kind of statutory provision. So, with respect, I think it's a little bit ridiculous that for this reporting mechanisms in this treaty, we've got to provide the statutory obligations on departments to enable justice to perform functions it performs under that other departments perform under other treaties. So really, what I'm saying is, known when we ratify a treaty that there is a lead department which has to report. Why does suddenly justice need statutory provisions forcing BSD, NCA, or NPA to under justice to cut their money and not for other treaties? And you wanted to set up an inspectoral committee for your reporting. So, Chair, I think the solution for me is the reporting requirements should go into the bill, which are the responsibility of the lead department, which happens to be justice. And, that's the way to get what they need to get.
No, I'm actually quite flabbergasted that we have to resort to this kind of legislation to force the department to work together. But I agree with Andrew Jeffrey. Lucky the department together they need to get, and if they've tried and they're not getting cooperation from the other departments, they must be in the report. they must report to us, and then it's up to us to take it up with the supervisor.
Flagging the whole issue and going to discuss it again. In terms of the umbrella body that we proposed in this on page 64, which would be a combination of clauses 42 and 43, what we're proposing here would amount would result in a massive lot of a whole range of consequential amendments to the Child Justice Act and to the Sexual Offences Act, because as we've already alluded to, we've been suggesting that there's an umbrella body and then there would be three subcommittees, and what we have in mind is that the responsibility of all responsibilities in those three pieces of legislation of the intersectoral committee or the subcommittee, would the detail would be taken out of the two acts that are already there and be put into regulations, and likewise, we would do the same thing here. Do you want us as drafters to prepare those amendments so that they can be discussed if you do decide to go ahead with the multi?
So it doesn't look like we're going for that. You know, it may be a matter for, maybe there should be an intersectoral committee for sexual offences and child justice. Maybe then that should be a judicial matters amendment rather than here.
I think let's just make sure that they insert that reporting requirement there.
Yeah.
Without
the existing provision that Mr. Jeffries referred to, that will change.
So we're clear.
And then on the point about the concern of the departments not responding, I mean, 43 would remain, which is the, it's the new 43 on page 66. Which is a reporting to Parliament. Page 66, the top was a 43, which is in heading, page was on the other, heading was on the other side, report to Parliament, that will remain.
Alright. Brings us to that particular clause 43 on page 66. We haven't made any amendments bar to insert that ministry. Look, delete. You see there's a footnote on 61. Portfolio committee to guide as to deadlines. I think, again, the portfolio committee wanted to think about the deadlines that are spoken about here every year thereafter, submit reports.
It's not, it is only 35 cases, then it's not going to be much work. So a annual report is not going to be a problem. If there are a lot more than 35 cases, well, then there's more we need to know about.
Within 1 year and thereafter.
Then we go to regulations. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into this. It sets out in the various sub clauses the responsibilities of the various ministers who are required to make regulations. And sub clause 1 deals with the Minister of Home Affairs, and he must do it in consultation with a whole range of ministers. The manner in which a coroner has been issued with the letter of recognition, the manner in which the DG Social Development must request an extension of the recovery and protection period. I don't know whether you want me to go into those details. The one that we have taken out in paragraph A, we recognise the fact that making regulations regarding the certificate issued to a person who is certified to be a victim of trafficking is really not a responsibility of current affairs, and we've removed that to social development. Subclause 2 deals with the domestic social development's responsibilities. As far as regulations are concerned,
sorry, I'm not quite confused. It looks like you've taken out A of that certificate, but you've just replaced it with a letter of recognition. You haven't changed it for still have a fair. Got to issue the letter.
You're about to delete today. Just about there.
You said you replaced it with social development. It's not, because the certificate we have decided not to use certificate, but instead we're using the letter. But it's the same thing.
Okay.
It must be social development that issues the letter of recognition.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yes, but that's not. I mean, Ms. Schaefer's. I mean, one, Mr. Bassett is correct. Regulations regarding Minister of Home Affairs to issue the certificate are not correctly placed. It's not the Minister's responsibility. B, then, is the manner in which a coroner, and it's incidental, who has been issued with a letter of recognition, will be granted approval to remain. That's a Home Affairs matter. So it's correct.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Chair. Subclause 2 deals with the Minister of Social Development's responsibilities as far as regulations are concerned. And we've taken out the first paragraph, 164. This must be deleted if there's agreement that the requirement of written consent by a victim to be reported is to fall away. That we did, I'm just having a look at that footnote now, but last week we did, so we've got to revisit that first sub-paragraph in the light of our discussions last week.
On that, I was waiting for an opportune moment. The issue of that consent to the victim and the issue of whether of compelling professionals to disclose. Is there international, is there better than, first of all, any other legislation compelling, I understand that there might well be, compelling professionals to disclose issues like regarding their patient? And if not, is there some international guidelines? Could we have perhaps have a comparison between what other countries do on those issues? Maybe not necessarily now, but you can investigate for it.
What is here is the appeals and review procedures, which we had asked for, and it's in the section we dealt with last week.
So some of these are going to have to be reviewed as a result of our discussions last week.
Yeah, my question is this B on the bottom of page 61. Why is that a different 67? Why is that a different section to A? Why is it not one of the categories under A? Are there different people who need to be consulted? Finance is not here, it's covered elsewhere, isn't it? Okay.
Right. So
is it because of finance?
I think in the accreditation of, I think accreditation of...
Okay. All right, I'll report.
So I get a sense that we finished with page 67, am I correct?
Yeah.
page 68, subclause 3. provides the minister, that's our minister, may after consultation with the various other ministers make regulations regarding any matter that this act requires or permits to be prescribed. Most of the regulations I think are going to be made by other ministers, but I think this is just a safety clause in the event of our minister having to make any regulations.
Surely that should be number one. The implementing body is justice. So the regulate power of the regulation of the Minister of Justice should go in first. And then seeing you just remember that section on the that we said shouldn't go into the national orders relating to the transport, that needs to be covered in regulations. You need to find the place to put that in.
What we intend to do is to go once we ready to virtually clean up the bowl, is to let to have a check everywhere in the bowl where the regulations are to be made and make sure that they are covered by each of the ministers and so that everything is listed in this clause as well.
Right. The provision under 4B, any regulation made under this section which may result in expenditure for the state must be made in consultation with the Minister of Finance. So if that is the case, if we go back to 2B, why is that a separate section? Should that not be just under 2A? Because you're going to have to consult with the Minister of Finance anyway in terms of 3B.
And then in subclause 4, any regulation made under this section must be submitted to Parliament for approval. I think think about that.
Chair, yeah, can we not also look at a deeming provision there as an option? I can't really use it.
And then we've inserted a new subclause 5. Which says a person who contravenes a regulation which prohibits certain conduct or fails to comply with the regulation which obliges certain conduct is guilty of an offence.
The regulation is now constituted by regulation. Is this normal?
That's what I was told in another meeting.
Dr. Chairman, yes, we've had this discussion in another meeting. The regulations will require certain forms to be filled, certain things to be done on time, certain things to be assessed, statement to be made. It's a broad range of things. I would at least wish to have a ceiling on the penalties. Should be guilty of an offense punishable in terms of such regulation not to exceed 1 year of imprisonment.
Yeah, it was to put all the penalties into one, but I think it might be useful to put specifically for this one, because the penalty clauses were regulated, clauses of this nature, your penalty clauses are really not exceeding imprisonment, not exceeding 6 months, 1 year. That's the
I mean, with B, failing to comply with the regulation which obliges certain conduct, I mean, I really don't think we should be criminalizing not handing in things on time or putting forms. I mean, if we're going to do this at all, then we need to identify that more specific offense. But it's not that kind of general.
Sorry, I want to know. In terms of then this four, no, what's it called, five, the criminalization of the regulations, which regulations is this referring to that would require criminal sanction? Because the ones I can only find are, one could go through them, you know, the manner in which the foreigner will be granted approval. Okay, that's the first one, the Home Affairs. So if the DG of Home Affairs doesn't do it, they're going to get zapped by five. B is the manner in which the Director General, C is the manner in which the extension period must be granted. So again, if the official doesn't grant it, they're going to get zapped by five.
the manner in which the person must be informed. And if one carries on, look, I'm being a bit facetious, but I can't find any regulation in here which requires criminal sanction for breaking. You want to nail accredited organizations who submit false reports.
Yeah.
Where is that's not covered here. I don't have a problem with that. But then maybe it's better to have a crime section under relating to those accredited organizations. But in these regulations, I can only just find you know, you can't say the manner in which the accredited organization or provincial department of social development must deal with a person in terms of 1214. I can't remember what that was. So, if the provincial department or the accredited organization don't deal with them properly, you whack them under five. They've committed a crime. So, I don't like five because I don't know what you're criminalizing. I can see that there are sections that would need to be criminalized as far as the reporting and mechanisms. But I just don't think you've done it right here.
Chair, I would just like to refer you to footnote 171, and you will see that the department has included this amendment based on the request by the portfolio committee. And we've looked at it, and we were also not sure what would constitute an offence.
I think we asked for it. If maybe for my colleagues, can anyone like, does anyone really want to keep this in for the moment, or do we want to keep it and relook at it? But
the concern was the reference
that the problem was initially the idea was to have the offences only in the regulations and no reference in the Act to the offences. And then we said there must be a reference in the Act to if you're going to create it in the regulations. And that's why we introduced it here. But it's still very vague. This is not offences. It's offences for breaking the regulations, which doesn't seem to make sense.
So
yes. And most of them then will go and hit the officials facing us. So I think if the answer be, I don't have a problem with crimes like false reporting and stuff like that. Those can be crimes, but then they're put down as crimes properly. That, you know, the relevant section, it's a crime if you supply very incorrect information. So I think look at it from that point of view. Okay.
Or people disclose information about victims or something like that.
Yeah, that's
I do, Chair, it's very, I think this a provision of this nature is put in the event of you needing it when you come to the regulations, and at this stage we don't really know what we're going to need, but I hear what Mr. Duke is saying, that the nature of the regulations doesn't seem to necessitate that.
The simple thing is, if this person and the steelman can find a regulation they think needs criminalisation, please then show it to us.
Thank you, Chair. We do not have too much amendments here except for going to the hearing of clause 45. We have deleted the reference to the National Commission of the South African Police Service, and I would like to refer you to footnote 172. The top inserted is section 15 of the South African Police Service Act already provides for delegation of power, and in a reference to sub should be removed from clauses 45 until 47. So you will see throughout from clauses 5 until 47, we have to move the reference to the National Commission.
Yeah, so Chair, look, the police that are out of the delegations, there's three clauses on delegations, 45, 46, and 47.
Because the police say that they've already got it provided for it to pursue unread in the future. Do we need any, that then is going to leave other public servants. Are their delegations not covered elsewhere? It just seems strange, I haven't come across so many delegations on this before. So Chair, I want to suggest that Can Sing, this was mainly here for the police, because if you look at the sections, it was where the headings were delegation powers by National Commissioner. Although I admit it's also referenced to Director Generals. But if the police had then come out because they said that they need it, do public servants need it? Do the DGs need it? Can you check on that? Because if you don't, if it's covered by the Public Service Act, which I would imagine there would be a delegation section, then these sections would not be necessary.
Chair, that sort of brings us to the end of the bill or the schedule, which has got all the consequential amendments. Yeah, nobody wants to deal with that.
I was going to suggest, also that those are consequential amendments, so there's nothing new.
Immigration Act, which has been amended, would you need to re-look at that in view of your discussions at Home Affairs? Were you referred to be the temporary resident, depending on what decisions taken, when you consult Home Affairs?
We will, but I think what we need to do, part of our discussions along the way as well, and changes that have been proposed, I think we need to check all the amendments in the schedule are up to date.
Way forward. How long will they take to do the amendment to us? How long will it take?
I think we have today. We've already done the stuff that we did last week. Some of the things might be a bit tricky, especially when as a department, we've got to have a look at those compensation things, and we've got to have discussions with social development. I would say, can we ask for a week at least?
We've got plenaries next week. A week after is then committees. That's MDG workshop, which I don't know if it's a big part of it. But maybe we could look at. They also need to have discussions with. We want to get close to finalising. So they need to have. The other outstanding thing for me was Home Affairs. In terms of the. Regulate the provisions relating to the coroners. Although I don't think it's that complicated. It should be according to protection under existing law. An additional category of your traffic, you can then not be no summary deportation or the cooling off period or whatever. The visit to the temporary permits and then possibly refugee. Applications, permits rather than permanent residence. So it's unfortunately for them longer. But they need to do that. But I don't know what our program is next week, but next week or the week after, Chair, I would suggest.
Next week or the week after.
Yeah.
That's sufficient time.
Some comparative stuff on the content issues then.
But if we continue the process whilst it's still fresh in our minds,
yes.
So we can week off the next party final.
I'm sorry to come in at the end. It would also help us with the drafting if we know what the committee's views are about the interpretation provision clause 1 or clause 2. We discussed, and I know this Danal with the NPA has submitted a document on the deeming provisions that we spoke about. They are in the bill at the moment. And quite a few of the provisions hinge on whether they're going to be in there or not. I wonder whether the committee has had a look at this Danal's document. You were asked to prepare. Give us guidance on what we need to do.
a chance to react on
it. So just leave it in for the time being. We got the document this morning, and we leave it in, and we can consider it when we meet again.
I would also like to hear what Bassett thinks of those provisions. Because, I mean, NPA have an interest in showing the net as wide as possible. We want to be synthetic, but at the same time, we've got to balance out the rights of the accused. So it would be, I think, the department would have a more balanced, hopefully, viewpoint.
Alright, and then the case looks like as far as this is concerned, we've done for the day. Honourable members, tomorrow we're engaged in public hearings on the Criminal Procedure Amendment Bill. Initially, we had thought we would at leisure go on until about 4:30 in the afternoon. Events have overtaken us, and we intend to complete the hearings by 1. I will need your cooperation as far as that's concerned. We have seven. Then, just another matter. You recall we had the Magistrates Commission before us. Well, they've been in touch with the association. No, we had the Commissioners before us. Yes, disciplinary matters. You had me worried there. I didn't realize there was an association. Oh, Joasa.
Yeah.
No. This is the commission itself. Sorry. And they've been in touch with Mr. Romano. I'm just a messenger. They're available on Saturday, the 17th of September, between 10 and 12, to meet with the committee in Pretoria. Yes. Well, we had certain concerns, remember.
Do you know, I can imagine that
the reason it's on a Saturday, he said hopefully, is because they're in court on Monday to Friday. So maybe we shouldn't be unsympathetic to that. Tell a lie. When I was on the commission, I suggest that the commission sits on Saturday because we're not completing our work during the week. We only sit for one day, Friday. So I think they're now sitting Friday and Saturday.
So that was the one that didn't attend the meeting.
So our response then is okay. Very good. I predicted to Mr. Romano that the committee would say, who are they to call us in Pretoria on a Saturday morning? But, alright, okay. Then we'll respond accordingly. All right, thank you. So, I've instructed Mr. Romano to start the process. Oh, okay. Let me do that. Mr. Ambrosini, we're not quite done. My apologies to you. Mr. Jeffrey has made what I believe to be an important proposal. Parliament is going to Mangaung sometime in September. Mangaung, it's now known as Bloemfontein, but its official name is Mangaung. It's the taking Parliament to the people. And we thought we would piggyback on that process as a committee and do some oversight work in Bloemfontein. Supreme Court of Appeal, High Court, certain magistrates' courts, Child Justice Center, amongst others. Yes. That's the 19th of September, which is the Monday after our tutorial.
Yeah, I don't know how many days it is, but that week there's no feederies. So it would be the 24th, I think, is Heritage Day, which is Friday.
Yeah.
So it would be like the Tuesday, Wednesday, whatever, I don't know. But it would be in the course, so I think that would be a good
place. How could the liberation of the Supreme Court fall that week? Is that going to fall away?
Liberation. Alright, I think Mr. Romano is saying in that case then we might need to speak what's going
on. So that's our liberation.
Yes, our liberation. Yes.
So we will
so get back.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Because we can deliberate with the SEA.
Well, please recall the letter from the former Chief Justice that we are to engage with the President. So, there is that. I don't see why not. If you'd like, we can look at that too, as part of the program. Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, I know.